We welcome Rabbi Rami Sapiro as our speaker today. Rabbi Rami was ordained as a Reform rabbi in 1981, and he's earned a doctorate in religious studies in 1985. You can listen to his podcast, Essential Conversations, at spiritualityandhealth.com. Many of you read his column called Roadside Assistance for the Spiritual Traveler that he writes for Spirituality and Health magazine. Rabbi Rami has three books coming out in 2015, A Mount and a Mountain, volume on Genesis, an examination of the Golden Rule, and a collection of poetry. Rabbi Rami's topic today is, Why Are We Here? An Introduction to Jewish High Holy Days. Let us welcome Rabbi Rami.
Good morning. Good morning. Oh, I forget. Let me get my clock so I don't go over. So, who was reading Manly P. Hall? Was that you?
I'm sorry, what was it?
Who was talked to? Yeah. Linda, yeah, I love Manly P. Hall. How many of you are familiar with Manly P. Hall? Oh, we have to do a Sunday on Manly. Yeah, I mean, he's an amazing guy. I have one of his original, the oversized Secrets of the, what's it called, Secret Teachings of All Ages, yeah. It's just, he's an amazing character. And have fun with that. So I'm going to talk to you about Rosh Hashanah, the Jewish New Year. And I have to tell you, it's a little depressing. Normally, I mean, I was a congregational rabbi for 20 years. I would have 1,000 people come to listen to me talk about this. And I don't know, there's a few dozen here. Like, my career is over. But all right. Nothing I can do about that. And the reason I'm talking to you about it is because I take the flags that we drape every week seriously. I mean, part of it is we draw from the wisdom traditions of these different, But I would like to see us do more. I would like to see us identify key ceremonies or celebrations in each of these things and bring them into the fellowship. I mean, we should have some kind of Passover Seder, not a Jewish one, a Unitarian one. We should participate in the month of Ramadan. I'm not saying fast all month, but, you know, an hour or two. Yes. Between meals and snacks or something. But I can see there's such wisdom. December 8th, you know, it's Buddha's Enlightenment Day. We ought to celebrate Buddha's Enlightenment Day on the Sunday closest to December 8th. We claim as universalists that we are heir to all of these traditions, and we should make use of them. So I'm going to explain a little bit about Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur. Rosh Hashanah starts tonight. Yom Kippur is next week. It creates a 10-day holy day period we call the Days of Awe. And the idea is that it's in these 10 days that you decide how the new year is going to unfold. So if you go to a synagogue, which I don't recommend necessarily, I'm not, it's boring. But if you do go to a synagogue and you listen to the liturgy, one of the things that we talk about is that God writes your name in one of two books, the book of life or the book of death. Yeah, pretty serious. Roger's going, whoa, I'm not going, I'll tell you that. But the book of life or the book of death. And God looks at your behavior over the past year and says, all right, you know, you deserve another year, or no, you've had it. And then you have 10 days to change God's mind. Now, 90%+ of Jews, at least in this country, don't take any of this seriously. But this is still in the liturgy. So the idea is you have these 10 days to change God's mind. And there are three ways to change God's mind: repentance, prayer, and charity. So repentance in Judaism, we don't actually have a word repentance. It's teshuvah. It means to turn. To turn from whatever it was that was negative and leading you into the book of death. Turn from that behavior and do something better. So you can change your behavior. Another way to do it is prayer. You can just, you know, remind God of, you know, how great God is and how wonderful God is and how God, if you listen to Jewish liturgy, you did all these things for my ancestors, Abraham and Sarah, and you go through all these things. Oh, you were so great. You're so wonderful. You were so nice. Then do me a favor. don't write me in the book of death this year. Right? You can try to talk God out of it, or you can give God a bribe. And that's the charity idea. You could sort of buy your way out of the book of death by being very generous over the next 10 days and, you know, writing checks and helping people out in whatever way you can. So those are the three things that the liturgy talks about. That entire theology behind that, of course, drives me nuts. I think it's ridiculous. But it does give us a metaphor, if we switch it around, that I think is worth taking a look at. So I don't believe that there's a God with a book or anything like that. But I don't believe that God writes me into the book of life or the book of death. Let's get really quiet. You can hear somewhere up in heaven.
Wrong again.
But okay. I could be wrong. But I don't believe that. I believe that you and I write ourselves into a year of light that is life-serving or a year that is death-serving. So there is a prayer that I want to start out with that is adapted from the liturgy. So this is from my own liturgies that I've written. So this is the idea that is really at the heart of, you might say, Unitarian Universalist Rosh Hashanah experience. On Rosh Hashanah, it is revealed, and on Yom Kippur, it is sealed. Who shall live and who shall die? Who will live the fullness of each day? And who will live as if dead to each moment? Who shall be sustained by the waters of compassion, and who consumed by the fires of anger? Who shall live by peace, and who by violence? Who shall be fed by friendship, and who shall starve for lack of love? Who shall be tormented by life's storms, and who shall learn to ride them out? Who shall be impoverished by endless desire, and who shall be enriched by mastering desire? And that's actually drawn from the liturgy. But if you humanize it, if you turn it inward and not say, oh, God is going to decide whether you, because it's in the traditional liturgy, it's who will live, who will die by fire, who will die by water, who will die. They never tell you how to live. It's just like, who will live and who will die? Let me list all the ways you're going to die. It's like really depressing. So when they ask for the charity part, you go, yeah, here, take it. You know, give as much money as you can. So it's a very strange liturgy. But if you twisted it around, if you took that humanist element and highlighted that, then I think you get something that's really powerful, really meaningful. And the question that you ask yourself tonight, because Rosh Hashanah starts tonight, and that you ponder all day tomorrow is, am I living a life that is life-affirming, or am I, you know, a zombie? Am I part of the walking dead? It looks like I'm alive, but I'm really dead. And a lot of people I know, sometimes even myself, I'm a zombie. You know, I look like I'm alive, but inside, I'm not. Inside, I'm dying. And I'm dying because I'm trapped in something that I shouldn't be stuck in. I'm dying because I forgot who said it in the Joys and Concerns, but I'm in a relationship I shouldn't be in. I'm in a job I shouldn't be in. I'm holding on to ideas that I should have let go a long time ago. Whatever it is, we can get trapped in this living death. And that's the question you have to ask yourself on Rosh Hashanah. That's the question everyone ought to ask themselves on Rosh Hashanah. It's not the question that's asked in synagogues, but it should. And the reason it's the ultimate question or the core question for Rosh Hashanah is Rosh Hashanah is the anniversary, and there's a debate about this among the rabbis because that's what rabbis do, but it's the anniversary either of creation itself, 5,776 years ago, according to the Jewish calendar, those liberal creationists who think, the Christian creationists who think the world is 10,000 years old, they are totally wrong. It's 5,776. So, you know, that's the number that the rabbis give because they add up everyone's ages and that's what they, you know, in the Bible, and that's what they come up with. I think it was a Tuesday at around 4 o'clock God did it. But anyway, it's either that or, and you could make it an and, I suppose, or it's the anniversary of the creation of Adam, humanity. And for me, I like both of them. Friend of mine in Cincinnati last year, I've been trying to do this myself when I had a synagogue, couldn't get anyone to go along with it. But if it's the anniversary of creation, the ceremony ought to be in a planetarium. And he ran into the same problems that I did when he tried to do this last year. The planetariums were not, they didn't want to, they didn't have a program for that, and they didn't want to write one. But he found a, I guess you'd call it a portable planetarium. This company would come into your synagogue, in this case, his synagogue, and they turned it into a planetarium. Yeah. And then he restricted it to kids. Oh, my God. How stupid is that? I said to him. Why did you do that? But he said, oh, it was good for kids. No, it's really, that's a great thing to do. So if it's that, then, you know, that's one way to celebrate. Go to a planetarium tomorrow. If it's about, if it's the anniversary of the creation of humanity, and it's about asking myself the question, where am I as a human being? What do I measure it against? So the Jewish tradition says you measure it against the mission of the human. And the mission of the human is revealed to us in chapter 2 of Genesis, where God, you know, chapter 1, God creates humanity, male and female, in God's image for no reason whatsoever. It's, God was reading a book, what do I do with an idea? He had this idea, tried to walk away from it, but did it. And there's all kinds of debates in the rabbinic literature, was it a good idea or a bad idea? And mostly they think it was a bad idea. The conclusion they come to is why it happened is that God calls all the angels together. Because it says in Genesis 1, let us create Adam, humanity, in our image. So who's the us? So some of the rabbis thought it was angels. So he calls all the angels together and they have a debate. Is it a good idea? Is it a bad idea? And the bad ideas, the people on the angels on the side of it's a bad idea, don't do it, are winning the debate. And God is just bored with the whole thing. So while they're arguing, he just does it. You know, and then they go, oh, too bad, I did it already. Now we have to get to deal with it. So, we're created without purpose. There's no mission. We're just, God does it. And then we're supposed to be fruitful and multiply. But I don't think the mission of humanity is simply to have sex. But maybe because I don't have a lot. So I don't know what, and I'm trying to excuse myself. I don't know. But in chapter 2, you get a much better mission, I think. And that is, it says that, you know, after the world is created, there's nothing is growing. The world is barren. Now, chapter 1, there's a garden flourishing, but chapter 2 is a different story by different people. And in chapter 2, which an editor much later smushed all together, but in chapter 2, the story is God creates the world, but the world has no life. It's just sort of a dirt ball. And what's missing, according to the Bible, is rain and gardeners. So God makes the rain to happen and creates humans to be the gardeners. That's our mission. That we're supposed to, literally it says, till the soil. That's our mission. So then they have this debate. Well, what does it mean to till the soil? I mean, if you have a garden, if you have a farm, if you're in agriculture, which, you know, was the major way societies were organized when they wrote the story, that makes sense because you have your plot of land. The Bible is very concerned that each person has, you know, their family plot and you're going to till it, and that makes sense. But by the time the rabbis get a hold of it, people are living in urban settings, not the lands are owned by absentee landlords. People are subsistence farmers. It's a different world, and they start to rethink the idea of tilling the soil. And what they do is, I just realized I'm wearing a watch. Why did I have to get my clock to look at the time? Bizarre. All right. So how do we understand soil if we don't actually have dirt to work with? So they look back in the Bible again, in Genesis 1, and it says, or Genesis 2 even more explicitly, it calls humanity Adam. You know, we say Adam, and we turn it into a person. But the original intent of Adam means human, not man. Man is a word ish. It comes later after the creation of Isha, woman. Then we get the word ish, man. But Adam is the human. And it's a pun, I guess, or a play on words, from Adama, which means earth. So though our Bibles don't usually translate it this way in English, the only one I know who does is Karen Armstrong's translation of Genesis, where she uses the word earthling. and that's the best English translation. The earthling arising from the earth. And so that's the language. So the rabbis look and say, well, you are, you earthlings, you are the earth that needs to be tilled, not just the land around us. So we are gardeners in a more literal sense, if that's part of your experience. But we are all supposed to be tilling the soil of our own being. So what happens when the soil isn't tilled? I mean, what does tilling do? So tilling breaks up the hard, lifeless bits of earth, allows it to breathe, allows it to take in sunshine, allows it to take in water, and allows it to become fertile to, you know, bring forth new life. So they have this whole discussion that your job is to do that in the outer world, if that's, you know, possible for you, but in your own personal world. You have to look to see on Rosh Hashanah where you're dry, where you're hardened, where you're lifeless, where you're no longer bringing forth the ideas, the compassion, the justice, you know, all of that. Where are you dead to all of those things? And then till the soil, break up whatever it is that is lifeless to allow it to become life-giving. Now, that understanding of Rosh Hashanah, I think, is A, universal, timeless, and intrinsically compelling. Because, I don't know, maybe not for you, but for me, I look at my life, and over the course of a year, there's lots of patches of lifeless soil in my life. There's lots of places where I'm just sort of deadened for one reason or another. Didn't start out that way, but over the course of the year, things happen and whatever. You sort of, ugh, I don't want to deal with that, so you shut it down and you put it in the, you know, in some kind of box so it doesn't get any air, it doesn't get any light, it doesn't get any rain. It becomes lifeless. It can't evolve. It can't grow. It can't transcend itself. And those parts of me have to be tilled. Now, I'm assuming, I could be wrong, I'm assuming I'm not the only one, that you probably, if you look, you probably have similar things in your life that need tilling. To identify them, you need some time. So here's the High Holy Days, where we have this 10-day period from tonight till the end of Yom Kippur, whenever 10 days is. Someone do the math. You know, next week, to figure out, okay, this is where I'm lifeless. This is where that I need to be tilling my own soil. And then do something about it. What you do about it will decide whether you're writing yourself in the book of life or you're writing yourself in the book of death. And this is, you don't need God for any of this. I guess don't think of God in that way. So this is a purely personal human thing, but it can be done in community because communities themselves have their own soil that needs tilling. That's something that I wouldn't know how to talk about. It's your community. You'd have to look at that. But at least doing it for yourself, but not necessarily alone. You know, if you ever do meditation practice, it's so much more powerful, I think, to meditate with other people. Even though the meditation is private, even though it's, you know, your eyes are closed, you're not seeing the other people, you're not talking to anybody, just having the presence of other meditators can be incredibly powerful and feed your own meditation. My ideal of a synagogue would be, or a community wrestling with Rosh Hashanah, would be to come together for a day, and in addition to just fun things that we could do together, to come and have conversations, small group conversations, with people we trust over where the tilling needs to be done. Our own. I'm not saying we go, well, Monica, here's what needs to be tilled in your life. You know, that's not saying, I'm not saying that. We'll leave that to Donald Trump. But to be able to say, look, this is what I'm struggling with, and to have someone else say, oh, you know, I get that. I know that. I even see how maybe it manifests in your life. And to be able to talk to somebody about tilling my own soil and then participate in someone else's tilling, I think it would be incredibly powerful. So we have this ideal against which we measure ourselves. The ideal of being the gardener, being the tiller of soil. Then we actually have in the liturgy, I don't know if you call them tools, but principles through which you do the tilling. There are 13 of them. I'm going to go through them real fast, so don't. Oh my God, 13. No, it's not so bad. So in the liturgy, we would chant them. I'm not going to even chant the whole thing, but it goes, Adonai, Adonai, El Rachum V'chanun. It just goes on. But it's the first two, Adonai, Adonai, are articulating the ineffable name of God. And the idea is you have a layer of yourself, two of them, in fact, that are beyond conceptualization. There's a part of you you can't know. There's a part of you beyond knowing. And they say it twice because part of it is that transcendent, you know, there's a limit to what we can know in this sense, you know, on the transcendent. And there's a limit to what we can know on the inside. So there's parts of you you can't know, but you're affirming that there's more to me than what I've manifested or experienced or tapped into so far. So I'm not done. I'm not finished. There's a bigger reality that I can draw from. El is the third one. It means God, but it's Elohim as in the first line of the Bible, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. It's considered the creativity intrinsic to being a manifestation of the divine. So not only do you have these capacities that you haven't even tapped yet, you are intrinsically creative in the way you tap them. And if you use the creativity right, then you get the rest of these things. So the rest of them are compassion and grace. I have to do it in Hebrew. Wait, I have to do it. Rachum v'chanun. So compassion and grace. Erech apayim literally means having a long nose. Now, it's not the Jewish long nose. That's not what they're talking about. They're talking about when you get mad or disgusted, you crinkle your nose, and you have. But the life you want is a life of an uncrinkled nose. You want a life of calm, and you can handle stuff, and you never get mad, and you never go, oh, that stinks. You never have to crinkle your nose. This is very tranquil, bringing out this quality of tranquility in yourself. Rav Chesed ve'emet means overflowing with kindness and overflowing with honesty. You have the capacity to be both of those, infinitely kind, infinitely honest. But they put them together. So there's a true story about Ram Dass. Remember who Ram Dass is? Richard Alpert, Harvard psychologist who goes to India with LSD, discovers yoga and Hinduism, and gives up the LSD, or so he says, and teaches his version of Hinduism. And his guru, Babaji, said to him, go back to America. And he said, well, what do I do? He said, just tell the truth. So he came back and he started telling the truth, but it was this harsh truth. You're this, you're that, and people hated him. And he went back to India and said, look, I'm telling the truth. Everybody hates me. And Babaji said, well, how are you doing it? And he goes, no. You have to tell the truth through kindness. You have to be kind about it. You can't just be dunning about it. So in the Hebrew liturgy, the same thing. It's truth and kindness, but they're connected. Then there's, let's see, the Rachum v'chanun, Erech apayim, Rav Chesed v'emet, Notzer Chesed l'alafim. Notzer Chesed l'alafim means you remember the kindness of other people for 1,000 generations. So you don't remember, oh, you did this to me last week. You forget all those things. You remember, oh, I remember the last time you did something nice for me and the time before. You only remember the nice things. I should have written these down. They're just in my head. Then noser ches, noser avon vafesha v'chata'a v'nake. So there's four left. Nosa is to forgive. And you forgive three things. You forgive deliberate transgressions. Someone aimed, they went after you. And you forgive them for that. And then you forgive things that people did, but they didn't do it. You were just collateral damage. You know, the first one is, I want to get you, and they got you. You can forgive. You have to be able to forgive that. That's part of your inner capacity when you draw on those, the divine fullness of which we are a part. So you have the capacity to forgive even people who went out to get you and did. Then you have the capacity to forgive people who were just going about their lives, but they did something in such a way that it caused you suffer. It caused you to suffer, but they didn't intend that. And you can forgive that. And then the third one is they went after you specifically to bring you joy, but the way they went about it actually brought you pain. So you can forgive them for that too. And then the last one is nake. It means to cleanse. And it means to just why you have the capacity to wash away all the negativity that you've stored up, accrued, whatever you want to say, over the last year. You can forgive all these things from last year, and now you can let go of anything negative. And so that you can start next week when Yom Kippur ends, everyone wears white traditionally at Yom Kippur because you're cleansed. It's all, everything is forgiven. Everything is washed away. Now, again, I don't believe God does any of this. I believe that we have the capacity to do this. And in this kind of setting, a Unitarian setting, a more humanistic setting, this would be something that I think everyone could benefit from. And I'm hoping you'll take the ideas home and think about them over the next few days to say, okay, my job is to till the soil. Where am I dry and lifeless? What needs to change? I have these capacities, these 13. You can read all about them in my book, The Sacred Art of Loving Kindness. I didn't bring any, but you could get it on Amazon, where I go through all 13 with exercises from different religions on how to practice each. But how do I make myself more honest and kind at the same time? How do I draw on these greater capacities? How do I make myself creative? How do I improve on all these different areas, forgiveness and all the rest of it? And then start on Yom Kippur. So I'm going to stop so we can wrap up the service and then we'll come back and talk back and we can go into this more in detail if you'd like. But I thought I would end this with blowing the shofar. Maybe. So you get two kinds of sound out of the ram's horn. And this is an actual ram's horn. The ram is outside. You have to screw it back. But you don't kill the ram for the horn. The horns either fall off or the ram has died and you take the horn afterwards. You don't kill the ram for the horn. But you get two kinds of sound out of a ram's horn. One is the sound you're looking for, and the other is the sound of a dying cat. So, and I never know which we're going to get, because there's no reed. It's just the horn chopped off, cleansed, and you have to do this. So the purpose of the ram's horn, historically, was to call everybody together. Well, there's a debate. Either they were calling everyone together for self-defense, right? The enemies are coming, and we're calling everyone to take their positions and defend the tribe, or it was to call everyone together for free bags of Ricola. So that's the third song.
Ricola!
So I think it was the first one, but I could imagine maybe after you blow it, you need Ricola candy. We're going, what the hell is Ricola? You have to look it up. All right. So you blow the ram's horn. I won't go through the whole thing because it's long. But you blow it once with one note, and then you do three broken notes, then nine really broken notes, and then one whole note again. And the idea is you start out whole, and then stuff happens. You start to your life starts to break apart, and then for some of us it gets shattered into nine little pieces. But it's symbolic. It's just shattered. But at the end of the year, if you do this stuff that we've been talking about, you can actually tap into this greater divinity, this greater capacity that each one of us has, and reclaim the wholeness. Because, they'll tell you, because you start whole and you end whole, the brokenness is always, what would you say, like encompassed in a greater wholeness. So it's the wholeness itself is never shattered. You discover that the wholeness includes the brokenness. If that makes any sense. So I'm going to just do, well, I'll see what I can get out of it. Okay, so we'll start with the whole note, see what I get. Whoops, last whole note. Okay. All right, thank you.
I should have played with the piano.